Correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role. www.d20radio.com.
Roll for initiative.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the Roll for Initiative podcast, issue number 10. I'm your host, Vince, along with DM Jason and DM Nick. How are you tonight, guys?
We're both doing great.
Hello.
Well, we got a great show for you guys tonight. Action packed and full of adventure and
full of old school gaming goodness.
Yes, old school gaming goodness with a touch of just newness in it. You know, whatever. But anyway, if you want to get in contact with us, rfistaff@gmail.com or visit the website rfipodcast.com. And tonight in our Sage Advice section, we're going to answer a few questions, and we have a new feature, Jason, the voicemail.
Yeah, we got our first caller.
Very exciting.
And then we'll go over that briefly, how you can also get in and get your soundbite played on the show. But let us head into Sage Advice. So what do we have tonight? Tom wrote us in for the first letter, and he wants to know, how do you guys handle magic underwater? What effects do you use on it, and how does it work with you guys in your games?
Want to take this one first, Jason, and I'll chime in? How do you want to do this one?
Well, I'm going to be pretty theoretical about it, because I've wussed out as a DM, and I've never actually had any combat or magic go on underwater. Really, just because it's enough trouble with these guys just keeping track of them when they're above ground.
So. Aren't you going to soon?
Yes. Well, I actually kind of thought it was going to happen to them recently because of the time they've spent out and around Salt Marsh.
I was going to say, yeah.
So I had all of my swimming rules ready to go and my breathing underwater rules, and I'd figured all of that out. But they're pretty low-level characters, so the magic underwater rules, the only thing I really would have had to worry about was sleep or magic missile. And I would have just let those go, you know, as far as those, I would just let them go as is. Now, I know that there's some magic spells that deal with things like electricity or sound or other things that would be affected underwater. And yes, with those, I mean, personally, I think it'd be kind of more fun to treat them in just sort of a standard physics way, not allow magic to give you any special advantage. Mm-hmm. And so if it's something that requires sound to travel in a certain way, the sound's going to be dampened by the water just like it would be in real life.
Right.
Now, would you also add like a negative penalty or a special effect to the spell because of hand gestures in the water? Or
That's actually a pretty good one. I hadn't thought about that. You know, you should.
Yeah, you should. Well, technically, I think most of us know that sound travels faster underwater, but there's also that thing about the whole spell component issue. Spell components are going to get mushy.
Well, actually, that one did just come up in our game because one of the spell components that was necessary was a cricket in a little cage. And for some reason, it's blanking out on me right now which spell it was. But it was a very important spell, and you needed to have a cricket. I think it was sleep. Yeah, it's sleep. And because they were trying to get their way into the lizard man's lair, and there's a lot of waist-high swamp water to get through, part of the problem for this particular magic user was making sure that his cricket didn't get wet.
Oh, okay.
Well, obviously, we know the obvious effects if you use lightning underwater, what's going to happen there. Just about everybody wearing metal armor or having metal items in their hand. What's going to happen with the fireball?
Fireball's not going to work.
I like it not working.
Now, I looked this up. According to the DMG, page 57, it's got a list of all spells that don't work underwater. And fireball's one of them.
There you go.
You know what I would probably do, just for a fun little added effect, because someone was stupid enough to use Fireball, is the spell. You guys are laughing.
I can't wait to see where you're going with this.
Yeah. The spell doesn't go off. Well, the spell goes off and the Fireball dissipates, but it boils the water.
Ooh.
Oh.
How about that?
Like around the caster.
Yeah.
It doesn't go anywhere. It just bloosh.
Yeah, he boils the water and the caster would take damage. People around him would take damage. And wow, that sucks to be them.
Yeah,
great, you can set up a little radius of just exactly how much damage for how far out.
Yeah,
actually, that's funny you mentioned that, like a negative effect on a spell. On page 57, one of the spells that has a definite negative effect is Odaluk's Freezing Sphere.
Apparently,
the description is, this spell is extremely dangerous to the caster if invoked in the first manifestation while submerged. The globe of absolute zero matter, and now absolute zero, when formed underwater, will instantly freeze the water around the caster in a block of ice of a volume equal to 50 cubic feet per level of the caster.
Hmm. I think they were taking some liberties with calling it absolute zero, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, what, negative 250 some odd degrees below zero, but
well, absolute still. Zero is... cold death of the universe.
Mm. Right.
So not actual, well, whatever, let it be absolute zero, fine, but the effects of that, I'd like to know if there's any physicists listening right now that could write in and tell us exactly what really would happen if you suddenly had a sphere of absolute zero anywhere. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
But yeah, there's a whole nice list of all the different spells there.
I mean, even the cold background of space isn't at absolute zero.
Right. Awesome. Well, all right. There you go, Tom. If you have any more questions, just give us a holler. I'm going to move on to the next email. DM, well, he calls himself DM Bill, said he loves the show. He tunes in every week, and he said that we all have different backgrounds, and he appreciates it. He said, Jason, you sound like Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory.
Okay, so I've never seen The Big Bang Theory, and I don't know
who that
is. You
have not seen it yet?
I've never seen
it
either.
What is it?
Oh, my God. It's like one of the best uber geek show on the planet. It's on CBS.
I don't have a TV.
Damn.
Sorry.
No wonder you hate laptops inside of a game.
Yeah.
You can probably watch it on your laptop through their website. In fact, I'm pretty sure you can.
So who's Sheldon?
How do I put it? they're all like geniuses at a university in California.
Uh-huh.
And they're all kind of gamers, too. Xbox gamers and whatnot.
Okay.
And Sheldon's kind of, how do I put this nicely?
I don't know.
He's kind of annoying, but nice. I like him. He's like my favorite character.
Okay.
So, Jason, you're kind of annoying then. That's basically what he said. No, I'm kidding. He did not say that.
I think it's just awesome. The voice thing. No, it's really cool. You should check out the show. My wife loves it. My wife loves the show.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Yeah,
it's awesome. That reminds me.
Who said this? Bill? That's DM Bill?
DM Bill, yes.
All right, thanks, DM Bill.
This reminds me of another show called The Guild that was came out in 2007. It was like two episodes, but it was based upon a girl who was playing World of Warcraft online with her guildies, and they finally decided to meet, and what happened?
Oh, God.
The one guy just shows up at her house randomly, and he's like, I'm in love with you, and she doesn't know what to do with him in the house.
It's quite
funny.
Was this on TV, too?
Yeah, it was, actually, at one point.
Wow, TV's got good stuff, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so DM Bill goes on to say that Nick sounds a bit like Drew Carey with a general-sounding approach to DMing. So you're from Cleveland, I guess, now, right?
Well, I live in Aurora, Ohio, which is I'm a spitting distance from Cleveland.
So you're
don't spit on Cleveland.
Yeah, don't spit on Cleveland. We like Cleveland.
That's okay.
And yeah, Cleveland rocks. And he
yes,
says,
it does.
And he says Vince is, well, Vince, which sounds more laid back as far as DMs go, but he doesn't say anything bad by any means. And he didn't mean any offense to anybody about these things. He's just giving his opinion. He sent in a whole large list of different insanities he's used in his game and gave us a link, which I'll put up. And then he had one question that stood out was, why don't we have a second edition section in our show?
It's not a second edition show.
Nuff said.
Okay.
Well, as far as I know, there was never a What? A second edition of what?
Of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
I know the TSR stopped making AD&D stuff in 1988. I don't know anything else after that. If he wants to let us know about some game that he's into, I guess he could tell us, but I don't know what he's talking
about. What is the second edition AD&D you speak of?
Oh, man, we have no idea.
No idea what you're talking about.
But thank you for your email, DM Bill. And now we're going to go on to our new feature this week, the voicemail. Jason, you want to explain briefly how people can do this so they can call
also?
Oh, yeah.
There's a phone number on the website that you can call and leave a voicemail, and it'll come to us as an MP3. It's just a Google Voice number. I think you might even be able to click something. I don't know. But there's a phone number right there. Give us a call.
Actually, that's the button.
What's the number? Do you know?
No, it's a button you push and you enter your phone number and it calls your house, you said.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's not how it works. What it does is there's a button and you push it and it calls your house. And then when it calls your house, it actually hooks you up with our voicemail. So you'll get when you press there's a button on our website, really big button on the right, it says call me. And if you click that, it says put in your name and phone number. And then you'll get a phone call like a second later, and it'll actually be our voicemail calling you.
Oh,
so that's how it works.
Sweet.
Is there a way to just put the number directly so somebody can call it maybe in the future if possible?
No, because it's actually my personal phone number with some Google Voice rules around it, so I don't want to give that out.
Okay, so if you want to contact Jason personally. Anyway, we'll get right into that email. It's from Chris from Portland, and here it is.
Hi, this is Christopher from Portland, Oregon, and I just wanted to call and voice my support to Jason's feelings. MP3 is in fact for losers, but more to the point, I just wanted to raise the question about why the whole first edition community is so averse to new technologies. Seems like they'll only be happy with the podcast if you press it to a wax cylinder and Pony Express it to their house. And it makes me feel like they're only into first edition because they're too grumpy to learn something new. I know that's not the case, but sometimes it feels like it is, you know, looking through the forums. And again, just wanted to say you guys are doing a great job. And as far as the technology goes, I'm personally pretty excited about the prospects of the upcoming Apple iPad. If it can, in fact, read and use... you know, un-DRM'd PDF files, I think that would be a great addition to the gaming table. I know you spoke about laptops in a recent issue. For me, that might be great for the DM, but as far as players, I think that there's just such a potential for distraction with a laptop in front of you that it's not too good an idea for players, in my opinion. But an Apple iPad or a Kindle or something along those lines where the DM can actually look over your shoulder, make sure you're not, you know, writing emails and the like, could be a great addition. And just wanted to see what you guys are thinking about that. And again, just voicing my support for the show. You guys are doing great, and I love listening to you every week. Thanks a lot, you guys. Bye.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, so, all right, really quickly, just the thing with the MP3. The reason I said that the other week is because I really do like AAC as a file format because it lets you put artwork and chapters and stuff like that, and anybody who's got a Zune or an iPod can listen to it. So it pretty much covers a lot of people out there. So that's why I would encourage, you know, people to download that one.
As of right now, we only are covering the MP3 format.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get everything back on track. It's just, you know, we all do this volunteer, so we have to, you know, use however much time we've got.
That's true. We're not adverse to, you know, new technology. I mean, I could see where he's coming from, though, on that. He was talking about some of the, you know, older grognards about gaming, but I don't know.
But you know what? I'm one of those all the time. I'm going to completely fess up to sometimes I'm just grumpy. You know, sometimes I'm just sick of – because the thing is, I mean, like we've
said – Damn, kids, get off my lawn.
like we said on the show before, you know, I mean, I actually, you know, that's what I do for a living. I'm a technologist. This is what I work with. I'm always looking for that. I got right. my order in for the iPad. Mm, you know, I actually live about 4 blocks from the Soho Apple store. So, you know, I got my order in the moment 8:30 in the morning when it happened. But at the same time, it's this whole, you know, rushing to always use the new thing, always having to change to that, and people don't really stop and think about whether or not it's making things any better or not that I'm against.
Right. In fact, it might – I mean, it could be a benefit. Then again, it could be a hindrance to if you're talking about, you know, using something in gameplay.
I think the iPad would be awesome on the table if you just have all the books on it.
I would think the Kindle would crush it. Too.
They would crush it. All those books, they're heavy.
Shut up. Lame. Anyway.
You know, I like the Kindle idea. I like that Kindle because you can have, if you're lucky enough to get a whole bunch of stuff on PDF, boom, it's all right there in the small little pad. So that I think that would be pretty cool.
I took a I bought a Sony Reader back before the Kindle came out, and I put all of my Dragon magazines on it and all of my books because I do have them in PDF form. Mm-hmm. And the trouble with it was that with that small screen and you've got stuff that's formatted a certain way, you know, with magazines and books, with gaming books, it's not just text. It's the tables and the layout and everything. If you make it small enough so that the formatting is preserved, then you can't read anything on that little screen. And if you make it big enough to read, then you lose the formatting. And the same thing is going to happen with the iPad because it's only got a 10-inch screen that's smaller than a book.
Right.
So, and you know, the other thing is, I think, and maybe this is my own prejudice because I got started, you know, working in print myself, but I really have a love for physical things. And, you know, I actually, although I've got, I can't even begin to count the number of computers I got in the house here, I also have a nice Olivetti manual typewriter in the other room, which I use when I really want to write. Because sometimes, because you know why? Because I need to think, and I can't be bothered with all the stuff that's around, you know, surrounding my words when I'm trying to write something. And it's the same sort of thing at the table. If you have a group of people that are all, you know, really happy sitting there with laptops in front of them and have a good time playing that way, you know, who am I to tell you that you're wrong? But I just find that it's distracting. And there's something about being in a room with a group of your friends and you're just sitting there. There's nothing glowing or beeping or anything else. You've just got your books, your dice, your paper, your Doritos, your Mountain Dew, your Ho-Hos, your everything else. And you're just having fun like that.
You know, I can even take that to another level. Because I've been kicking around this idea for quite a few years. And I think I'm going to go through with it this year, this summer. Actually have a gaming session out camping. We go camping.
That's
cool. I have a pop-up camper. And I usually go with my, you know, my family. You know, the wife and kids, we usually go about once a month during the spring and summer. And there's a lot of nice state parks around here and a couple of nice private campgrounds. And I've been kicking around this idea. It's like, you know, why don't we one, you know, weekend, our group, we'll go camping, and we'll game while we're out camping.
I did that many years ago. One of my friends was in the Boy Scouts, and his dad was one of the leaders. And they were trying to get me to join, which I didn't join. But they tried to get me to join. So he's like, oh, why don't you come camping a weekend for us, which it was pretty cool. We went camping. But at night, we around the fire, we played Marvel Super Heroes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Totally fun.
Totally fun. So,
oh, man.
Thank you, Chris, from Portland. We appreciate your voicemail. And anyone else who wants to do that, just go to the website and punch in the number and leave us that voicemail. Or you can contact me on Skype because I have voicemail for my name, AlucardD20. And just leave a message there on Skype. Let it ring a couple times and it'll pick up automatically any time of the day. I have it on mute so you can't bother me. And our last email of tonight comes from another Tom, who is pro laptop in his game, and you guys know why?
No.
And no, I don't.
He actually, in his group, he uses a laptop for his nephew, who's over 2,000 miles away from him.
Oh,
and
okay.
He has a webcam on there, and he positioned it on the table so they could see him, and he could see them, and they can also see the gaming board. So he says they do it every week. There's really no lag whatsoever for it, and it's a lot of fun, and he's been doing it for quite a while now, and he gave some pictures, and he said the show's wonderful, and he told me I could post it up on the website. So I'll be doing that this weekend, posting somebody
That's
could
cool.
see it. Yeah, it really
that is cool.
Cool.
Has he at least dressed the laptop up all, you know, cyberpunk and I mean all steampunk and put brass around it so you can't tell?
No, Jason.
Ah.
He's getting there.
Yeah, he's getting there. But
no, that's a pretty cool thing. Actually, one of my favorite gaming comics has that situation happening in it every week. So the awesome. Full frontal nerdity, Aaron Williams.
Oh, okay, I've heard of that. Yes.
Yeah, really funny comic.
Mm.
Awesome. All right, that'll end the Sage Advice for this week at rfistaff@gmail.com if you want to send in your comments and questions to all of us. And we'll head over to the future.
Feature.
So what do we have for Feature 1 this week, Nick?
Well, the feature this week is using miniatures in your game.
Yay! Yep.
I love them.
So the first little bullet point we have here for miniatures, painting your own or buying the pre-painted ones. Jason, which one do you use at all?
Well, okay, so first of all, I've really changed my stance on miniatures in the past couple of years because I used to be pretty anti-miniatures overall. Mm. I just thought that, well, because I took sort of a all-or-nothing approach to them. I felt like if you were going to have miniatures that they were turning into, you know, a chess game basically, and I didn't want that. And I wanted people to be, you know, using their imaginations, et cetera. But then in the past couple of years, I've realized that there's, you know, a lot of advantages. We've always used bottle caps and dice and whatever when we have to quickly show marching order. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a nice miniature there instead of a bottle cap.
This bottle cap is the troll.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is, it's just, you know, I started painting my own miniatures for the first time a couple of years ago, and it was so much fun.
Yeah.
You know, when you get a really well-made miniature, and you know, that's just a fun thing to do is to sit around and paint them. So, you know, using pre-made ones, well, there's nothing wrong with it. It just kind of, it's not as fun.
I have to agree with you. I mean, I use the miniatures for my game, I think for most people, is just for, you know, for your own player characters or NPCs or what have you. I've enjoyed having those miniatures to represent my character on, if, you know, if anything, just to show the marching order, or if, you know, if you come to the, you know, the quote unquote big battle and, you know, the DM breaks out the battle mat, everybody wants to have, you know, something to represent their character out there when it comes to those points. And I love using miniatures for that, and I love painting them. It's kind of, it's almost, I don't want to sound corny, it's almost therapeutic.
Sure it is. But of course it is.
I've
you know,
that
it,
before,
that's not corny at all, because it's actually having that time to just sit there and only do that and focus on it. It's really good for you.
Yeah, I'll sit there and listen to my Rush albums.
Hell yeah.
Or you can sit and paint your miniatures and listen to RFI podcasts.
That too. I've done that too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now,
also, at
shameless plug.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say, you know, I have cheated on miniature painting in the past. Let me qualify this. I was able to get a hold of I think it was Steve Jackson Games.
Right.
They did a whole bunch of those cardboard minis.
Oh, I love those. Yeah.
The cardboard heroes. And a few years ago, they had like a big booklet of them. I was able to, snag a copy. I think they were going out of stock on their website, and I got this years ago. And I tell you, it's probably the most valuable, one of the most valuable resources I've had as a DM, because now that I got a scanner, if I want to make like a huge mass of orcs or zombies or goblins, you know, I could just print them off on my printer, and It's wonderful to have. If you want to have enough, I mean, they're paper minis, but I like them because when you get to those situations where you know where stuff's at, you know where stuff's at. I love it for that. It's great.
That reminds me of the cardstock building options that you can do.
Yeah.
There's a website that allows you just to download, buy it, of course, download it and print it on cardstock, and you just construct it following the directions they give you, and then you have your own 3D buildings or whatever.
Yeah. See, now you guys are actually playing a different game than me. And this is kind of why I was anti-mini to begin with. Because once you start getting to the point of actually having the terrain laid out and having all the different, you know, monsters that you're going to encounter and everything else, it's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different game to me. It's
more like a miniature game. That's true. But
That's kind of why I resisted it in the first place.
But you know, there are some people out there that they're just visual people. You know, they need that extra something to spark their imagination. You know,
it's nothing cool than going to someone's house and the last battle of the night. They have everything laid out in a nice big battlefield with buildings. It just adds a little visualization to it. I see nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. So before I say anything with that, you were saying before about having a miniature to represent your own character, and I just wanted say kind of give a plug to my favorite miniature company, though, one that I met the owner at Gen Con last year. They're called Dark Sword Miniatures.
Maybe they're a sponsor.
They just make great stuff. But the thing is that the guy who owns it is a first edition player. When I talked to him, the first thing he started talking about was how he only likes old school, and so he wanted to make the miniatures look old school. And he felt that all the new ones that were coming out from Reaper were, more appropriate for the kind of superhero fantasy approach. And so if you look at the Dark Sword miniatures, they look like humans.
Right.
They're very realistic, and they're beautiful miniatures.
Cool. You know what? There are two other companies, now that you mention, Jason, that I found out that are doing some old school stuff now. One of them is called Center Stage Miniatures, and another one is Otherworld Minis. I can't remember one of the two because I just saw this off of, I guess, another plug for Grognardia.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
He posted this, I think, about a week ago. That one of these two companies was able to get some molds that were used by a couple of miniature companies back in the late 70s, early 80s, and they're going to redo them. And at really good prices. Like, I saw today they had a miniature for, like, a cleric for, like, $1.75.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, old school minis at old school prices.
Okay, well, that brings us to our next little point here. The minis, old school or the current ones? Are you going to go searching for the old school type ones like Nick was just talking about, or maybe the ones from the 80s and the 70s? Or just say,
well,
screw it?
Well, they're different scales.
Right. Yeah. Are you just going to say, screw it, and just go for the ones for the current day?
Well, yeah, so that's the trouble, is that they're actually different scales. The old scale was a little bit larger, and they're a little bit harder to find.
Well, that's the...
So
I go with
newer, smaller scale actually, myself.
And Nick, you?
I say, for the longest time, I was looking for like player character minis for a number of years now. Reaper was like probably the only company out there. But now you mentioned Dark Sword minis and a couple of these other companies. I'm going to be looking into them and seeing what they're going to be offering. But I've been known to go out of my way, like when I go to Origins, this year. I'll be hunting around for some, old minis, like the old Raoul Parther stuff.
Thank you. If you just heard paper flipping, that was me flipping through a Dragon magazine trying to remember the name. That's the original mini maker. They're the ones. Reaper is a Johnny Come Lately, Raoul Parther. And I don't remember the guy's name, but the original sculptor, their first sculptor, now has his own company. And he's still making stuff, and they're just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've been getting my minis from Paizo, actually, because they've been making some pretty decent minis that look like ones from first edition. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I got to check that out.
Yeah, I kind of like the Paizo ones. You get to paint them yourself. They don't paint any of them. They say non-painted figures to help save costs for you. I'm like, okay.
Sweet. Okay.
Okay. Well,
Just so I found it, it was Tom Meyer. That was the guy, and his new company is called Thunderbolt Mountain. So that's the amazing miniatures. And they
Are they the guys in Southern Ohio? Are they out of Cincinnati, I think?
I don't know. Maybe. I could try to find out. But yeah. They actually make, if you do play with the 30 millimeter instead of the 25, they do make 30s and 25s.
Oh, cool.
But again, for me, I don't really mind too much what size they are because, you know, I appreciate, you know, your point that some people are more visual, et cetera. But that, to me, is what takes away from a lot of the game because I do play in a game where there's miniatures for everything and we spend all our time staring at the table. So a little bit less time, and I can't really picture the other players in my mind very well because all I can see is these miniatures that are always in front of me.
Yeah.
So far as size does not matter to you, huh?
Yeah, and the other thing is...
As far as miniatures are concerned.
Nick.
Yeah, I gotcha. But the other thing for me is, as a DM, I am not going to buy hundreds of dollars in paint. I just don't have the time for that. So part of it is just that for me as a DM, I'm not going to be able to have a miniature for every encounter that my players will ever encounter.
Well, luckily,
I do have an interesting story.
No, really?
I picked up some miniatures. I think it was 4 years ago. I went to Gen Con. And some dealer was able... They found a box of unopened AD&D miniatures like from 83 when TSR was producing their own. And they had like a whole bunch of...
Oh, those were kind of bad, weren't they?
They had a whole bunch of the monks, assassins, and thieves ones. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, oh, cool. It's unopened. Awesome. I'm like, okay, $10. What the heck? I'll buy them. I open them up. Half of them looked like crap.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, TSR had some pretty crappy stuff. They really did.
Yeah, when Grenadier was doing their stuff, it was really nice.
Yeah. So I guess the point is for me that the miniatures can be a lot of fun on their own, just as works of art, but I don't consider them essential gameplay. It's just they're a great thing. They're a fun thing to have with the game.
Yeah.
Along with using the hex maps and this, or I personally use the square maps.
I use the square battle maps too.
So yeah, that was the other bullet point that you had brought up.
Yeah,
the battle mat stuff. And you know, I've been doing different things. Sometimes I will, you know, if we're playing it at my office or something, we'll just draw on the whiteboard behind us, and I'll just kind of roughly draw what's going on. But I do have a battle mat, and I think that it's kind of useful just to – I'll only draw the room that they're currently in, and I'll erase it right away afterwards so that the players have to map for themselves.
Right. Yeah, that's a perfect idea.
Yeah, in my Hackmaster game, my friend Jeff's house, he made a table where the top part is the old green blackboard.
It's cool.
And then he took the time to do one-inch squares – with a yardstick on it.
Yikes.
In chalk.
No, he used a permanent marker, used a Sharpie.
Yeah, no, I was just joking. He did it chalk. Like we chalk wiped it all off.
Yeah. No. But yeah. I'm telling you, man, it is just great. When we go over there, if we just, all you need to do is grab a piece of chalk. Okay, boom, boom, boom. There it is.
Yeah, see, I'm jealous of you guys that don't live in the city and then actually have more than 10 square feet of space. That's awesome.
Yeah. At least got a basement.
When you live out here in
a basement, I've heard of those.
Yeah,
you people in that newfangled New York City don't know that basement thing.
New York City.
No. So you guys use battle mats. I use battle mats. I also use dungeon tiles because they actually, going back to Paizo, they sell a game mastery packs which come out every month, and they have some really cool. Like they'll give you ships, they'll give you prison cells, some really cool tile maps that you can use for your game. And I like to buy them every once in a while when they have something cool comes up. They have a graveyard, I'll pick it up or something. And I like to slap these down during the game once in a while to throw out something different for the players.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Pretty fun.
So tell us what you use in your game, rfistaff@gmail.com, and we'll head into our next section.
creature, theater.
So now for the creature feature theater this week, we have the doppelganger.
Yeah, this is a cool monster.
Classic monster, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I, when I went and looked it up in the Dragon magazine again, before I turned to the page, I already could remember the illustration in my mind.
Oh, you found that article?
Oh, yeah, it just came back instantly as soon as I saw the article. Like,
yeah,
I didn't even have to reread it because I remembered. I must have read that article like 3 or 4 times in a row when I first got it, you know, back when it came out.
Yeah, that's an excellent one. I guess it's part of the ecology series.
Yeah, it says here the psychology of the doppelganger.
Yeah, the psychology.
But it is the ecology series. Maybe.
Yeah.
Was it Ed Greenwood that wrote the ecology series ones? Is that why they didn't?
Yeah, the first one was the Piercer.
That was the first one? I thought the first one was the ecology of the beholder.
No, nope. Ecology of the Piercer was the first one.
Cool.
So, the doppelganger. What can a doppelganger do that's so special about the doppelganger?
It could be anyone.
Have you guys used this in your campaigns?
Yes. I've used them the wrong way, though. So,
oh,
you know,
really?
Now that I went back and reread this... I think when I used it, it was years and years ago, and you know, I didn't really appreciate all of the psionic abilities of the doppelganger because I've never played a game where I've really used psionics. I still don't.
I don't really use them either.
We'll talk about that in a different show.
Yeah, different episode.
Yeah, so that's kind of a shame. But the thing about the doppelganger is, you know, true to its name, a doppelganger can assume the form of any human. It's a very Star Trek kind of moment. And the thing about the doppelganger within the AD&D is that it has these ESP powers in order to actually not just read the mind of the person whose life they're about to take over, but also to have the ability to control to some extent and to be resistant to a lot of psionic powers along the way.
Yeah, on top of that, they know the person's past, everything about them, not just like their current thoughts, which is, in a way, pretty frightening.
Well, they're able to imitate and within 90% accuracy imitate the person. So, last time I used it in my campaign, I kind of made it like the Baron of the town was taken over and he was acting kind of strange. So, my players weren't getting it first, so I just started acting like William Shatner.
You're right. It's a total Star Trek thing.
Oh my god.
Spock.
Spock, yeah. So, that's how I've used it in my campaign. I used it for the Baron, and they finally figured it out after a really bad acting, and the Baron was acting fishy, so.
Well, the cool thing about the doppelganger, you know, actually reading the psychology article as opposed to just looking them up in the monster manual was finding out where they really came from and what they really want.
I thought it was interesting too. I think one of the more interesting things about the doppelganger when you look it up in the Dragon magazine, and it I don't think we mentioned it yet, but it's issue number 80.
Okay.
Yeah, December 1983. Yep.
83, you said?
Yeah, December of 83.
Oh, December of
80.
Okay.
And I thought what made this thing sound not just creepy but alien is they do not sleep.
They do not sleep, and they have no gender.
Right.
But they are human. That was what I thought was the really cool part. And when I – so let's – give a quick overview of what they are.
Okay.
So a doppelganger is human, as they discovered in this article when they tried to dissect one.
Yeah.
If you try to dissect the doppelganger – interesting fact, maybe interesting, is that when a doppelganger actually dies, its flesh turns to stone very quickly. So in the article, the person doing the dissecting had to do a lot of – magic,
chiseling,
trickery, and necromancy, actually, in order to
kill, that's right,
in order to keep him from going. But he discovered that, in fact, all the internal organs, everything, this was actually a human. And the doppelganger then explains to them that, in fact, doppelgangers are humans, that they were, in his mind, they were chosen by the gods. They were granted this this gift of, I don't know how long they live, actually, but they were granted this gift of being able to assume the form of anyone else, etc., and have all these ESP powers. And that they exist, essentially, that they look for the human whose life they feel like taking.
Yep.
And they go and they assume that. So they're not going to be jumping around from person to person really quickly unless it's to achieve their aim of finally taking over one particular person's life. And that's also how they reproduce, because having no reproductive organs or gender, they need to take the form of a human and then reproduce to create another doppelganger.
That's almost like an Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of feel to it.
What I like about the doppelganger, the opportunity it gives to a DM who, if you're the type of DM who likes to mix it up between different systems sometimes, you know, have that dimensional portal where all of a sudden your characters end up in Boot Hill or Top Secret or Gamma World, is I think the doppelganger could be a really interesting explanation, could be perhaps that they're from Gamma World, that they're either
species.
Or maybe travelers from the future. Who knows? You could just any story you want to come up with.
Yeah, I almost view them in a way. When I was going through my notes, I'm kind of like, I'm thinking it's like, it almost sounds like an alien race in a way. And you can almost, you could play it that way. Or you could play it like what Jason said. You could play it like maybe they're a mutant human species that got transported from Gamma World. Either way, as a DM, I think that would work either way.
Well, you know, there's some sci-fi worlds in which the aliens really are us. So, sure, they could be us gone to another planet, mutated, and come back.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would be really amazing. I don't know if there's ever been a commercially available module written around the doppelganger and that aspect of them. But
I don't know of one either.
It would be a great way to write an adventure.
Now, I do recall maybe a doppelganger being in an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the older TSR modules. I don't remember exactly which.
Maybe one of our listeners will.
But
yep. Good reason to write in.
Yeah, for some reason Temple of Elemental Evil jumps to my mind. There might be one in there, but I don't recall they're like a focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the doppelgangers are a focus of a particular adventure. It would make a really cool adventure, though.
Yeah, I like the idea of a doppelganger that has an ultimate goal. He's trying to perhaps, or not he, it, is trying to perhaps take over the life of one very powerful man or woman, and along the way has to kind of leapfrog from person to person to get there, and the adventurers somehow have to interfere with that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So write it up and send me your module when you're all done.
Yeah. That reminds me, you said jumping from body to body while he's trying to get away. Wasn't that movie with Denzel Washington and John Goodman? What was the name of that movie?
The
bad guy wins in the end. I can't think of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because
I have no idea what movie you're talking about, but as soon as you mentioned the title, you've already given me the spoiler. So what is it?
I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. It's very good. Denzel Washington's the bad guy in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I can't think of the name. Just remind me of the movie, because that's like one of the movies I can remember that the bad guy actually wins in. So,
yeah. Never heard of it.
Came out probably in the mid-90s.
I really got to get up on popular culture, don't I?
You need a TV.
Well, yeah. Or a movie ticket.
Yeah.
A movie ticket, yeah. Anyway, so that'll wrap that up for the Creature Feature Theater, and tell us how you use a doppelganger, and if you can remember the movie we're talking about, definitely write us about that so we can figure it out and tell Jason so he can go to the movie store and rent that VHS tape so he can...
Well, I'm not going to watch it now. You already told me how it ends.
No, it's still a good movie, though.
Yeah.
You need to get up with the pop culture, Jason, you know.
Right.
Do you have any idea what you're talking about? Why do I sound like I do?
Playing tips.
So, for playing tips this week, we have establishing a Stronghold Keeper temple, which happens around 9th level. What's the point, and why would someone want to do this? Nick.
What's the point? Or, you know, what's the point? Why? Is it good for me? Is it good for them? Who knows? I've looked through the rules on that. And, you know, they're pretty loose on that. There's the only one I found that was anything specific was probably the assassin. Right. He's got to literally jump through a lot of hoops to get what he needs done.
Oh.
Or slit a lot of throats. but, yeah, if you look under all the descriptions of the different player characters, of the fighter, the cavalier class, or, you know, the cleric, it gives each description, you know, at a certain level, you have the option of creating a stronghold, a temple, whatever. I look at it as for two reasons of why you would want to create something like that. One, revenue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you're, according to whichever class that you have to clear out a certain square mile of land around your stronghold, and anybody who's in that area, you collect basically taxes or tithes from. And it varies on, depending on the class. Some, I think, were like 7 silver pieces, and some were 10. But, you know, it's a definite revenue income type thing for a player character. And not just also having, you know, the keep or the stronghold, but the surrounding area could be arable land. So maybe you're in an area where there could be a potential of, you know, mining operations that you could establish too. So definite revenue possibility for a player character. And also when you create these strongholds and keeps, you're going to attract followers. And that could be a potential pool for, you know, future player characters. You know,
the other kind of fun thing about it is that once you've established this keep or whatever, your stronghold that you're creating, the people that you're attracting aren't just going to be the ones that want to serve you and help you. You're also going to attract perhaps some bands of evil adventurers, perhaps some low-level NPCs out to get themselves a little experience points and treasure on your behalf.
Right. You know, getting around that level, around 8th through 10th level, your character or characters, if they go into something like this together, which I have had happen in the past, where a bunch of characters will basically pool their revenues and they'll all create something together. They've made a name for themselves in the campaign world, and they're going to attract some enemies. So, yeah, you could definitely say that, Jason, that, you know, there might be some guys going out to look for them.
I think a big part of, you know, why to do this is it's just a great reward for your players.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, you're going up in levels, and what are you really getting as that goes along? You're getting a lot more gold pieces on your character sheet. You're getting a lot more hit points, etc. But the ability to suddenly change the way the game plays and start turning it into a much more complex game of palace intrigue when you want to.
Yeah, you know, the palace intrigue, socioeconomics, who knows?
I don't know. Every time I look at this, I the first word that comes to my mind is micromanagement. It's just like, I don't really want to sit around figuring out how many guards I have, how many people I have, how many taxes I have to collect all the time. What do I have to do with these people? What do I have to do with those people? It's just like, you know what? Nah, I'd rather not bother with
these. Well, that's why you hire a bunch of people that administrate that crap when you're out going to the astral plane killing Githyank.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that's kind of comes down to the gameplay style. If you really want to play almost a SimCity on paper, you know, sure, go for it. And if you don't want to get to those levels, you just kind of do what Nick said and say, well, you've delegated a lot of those issues. It will turn them into a die roll.
Yeah, but you have too many evil DMs out there like Nick that'll be like, okay, well, your characters are gone.
hey, would I do something like that?
Yes, you would.
I would.
And then you come back and your character's like, your stronghold is destroyed, it's in smoke and tears, your gold is gone, and there's a message left on there. Great.
Awesome. That's that. Now you've got a really good next hook to your adventure. Now you've got a revenge story.
There you go. See? Hey, yeah. When someone gives you lemons, you make lemonade.
The things I usually think about when it comes to these sort of things, there's, I go back a lot of times to my favorite fantasy authors and how they progress. You know, I like the fantasy authors who carry characters through many, many books, have the same characters. Robert Asprin is one of my all-time favorite authors, fantasy or not, and his semi-serious, semi-comical series of myth adventures follows the same path. Skeeve, the... you know, the lowly magician's apprentice eventually becomes the great Skeeve, court magician, and then one day has his own sort of keep or stronghold type of empire over on another dimension. And all of the books start playing off of what happens when he goes from being this lowly apprentice up to this powerful magician, and how it's a really great opportunity for your characters to really grow with their PCs, or for their PCs to grow with the game.
You just remind me of another series that takes a similar course, is the Guardians of the Flame series.
Who's the author? I don't know.
I think Joel Silverberg or Joel Rosenberg. Basically, it's about a group of people who play a D&D type game, get transported into the world in the characters' bodies, and they have to learn how to live in this world.
That sounds like an audio book called Dark Age.
Yeah, I think the first book came out in 82 or 83. And
well, let's write these down and put them on the show notes, because I'd like to find them myself.
Yeah, Guardians of the Flame series is very good, and you have all these different characters, and it goes over generations, too. One of the main characters, Carl, he...
Yeah. Sorry, I really like
not that
name.
Carl. Not the Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Never seen that either.
Oh, that's right. You don't have TV. Anyway.
Send it to me in newspaper form, or what was it? Put it on a wax cylinder and send it by Pony Express.
Okay. But he has a son eventually, and his son takes on later on in the series, but that whole thing where they get into the world, they have to make their way through it, fight the ultimate evil, but also along the time they establish a stronghold, and they have administrators taking care of certain duties, and there's some frustration along with it too that they experience. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, what do you mean I gotta collect money from these people out here in town? What
You know what? For some players, that might be a good reason for them to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. I can't handle all the bureaucracy and the boringness of this. And they just go off and give up their keep and, you know, say, I just want to get back to adventuring the way it used to be. And that might be perfectly normal for the player character.
That's true. That's true.
You know, but if you also want to take this as an opportunity to change up the way that you're playing your game a little bit, because you know the gaming group that meets every Friday night or every Wednesday night or whatever for 4 years, you get to the point where you want to do different things. So this is a good opportunity to start maybe bringing in some chainmail rules, or you know, whatever large scale. There's the old AD&D battle system. I don't know if you ever played with that. You know, there's an opportunity to say, you know, I've got a keep, I've got an army. Let's do tonight. We're going to have a large scale battle instead.
What do you think, Vince? Has that ever come up in your game about people establishing strongholds or keeps?
Yeah, actually, we're playing in a game right now that I'm not running. I'm playing in that we all just became barons of this one keep. This five of us is baron, which is kind of ridiculous. But, and all right now is just micromanagement and politics and going here and asking this person for that and asking. It's just like I finally said to the DM, I wrote him a little note. I was just like, because I'm playing a paladin, I was like, can I have my guy request that we all go out and try to find the Holy Avenger just to get us out questing?
Yeah.
And finally the DM's just like, you know what, you're right, I am kind of getting sick of this myself, so.
Yeah, I guess over like a prolonged period, maybe one session, you know, or part of a session you could do something like that, but I can't imagine like several multiple sessions dealing with something like that. I think you're right. It would get boring after a while.
Yeah, yeah. It would bore me to death too.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, tell us how you use it in your campaign. RFIstaff@gmail.com. We'll head into the Dragon's Horde next.
The Dragon's Horde.
So what do we have in the Dragon's Horde this week, Jason?
We have another classic treasure from the Dungeon Master's Guide. This is the Amulet of Inescapable Location.
Ooh.
Which pretty much says it all in its name. So if you happen to put this into a dungeon, don't leave the price tag on it. They'll know what it is. what it's going to look like when somebody finds it is an amulet on a chain or a brooch or, you know, wherever an amulet might go. And like all good cursed magic items, it looks like the exact opposite of what it really is. It
right.
looks like something that's going to prevent location. So if you have somebody that's detecting magic or using identify, they're going to figure that this is something that shields them from scrying. So, oh, this is great. You know, the Wicked Witch of the East will never be able to follow me now because I'm wearing the Amulet of Absolute Protection from Location. And it's, of course, exactly the opposite.
Pretty much throwing the bat signal up of where you are.
Yeah. Big neon sign.
You have the arrow. You are here. You are here.
Yep.
So any arch nemesis worth their salt is not going to descend immediately on the player characters as soon as this is found, but allow them to think that they found just the opposite for just long enough to create the maximum chaos and havoc.
Well, I like the fact that it would detect magic. It doesn't reveal its true nature. So
yeah, that's pretty sneaky.
Yeah. I like how you can just sneak around that as a DM, and I could see some evil DMs using this, Nick. And
who, me? No.
Now, the question that I have about it, though, is that if I go to the actual description, it says, normal determination attempts, including detect magic, will not reveal its true nature. But that sounds a little open-ended to me, like perhaps when Gary Gygax was writing those lines, he had something in his mind about something that would reveal its true nature. But he didn't say.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any opinions?
He might have written that and thinking later on to follow up on it, but just ran out of time or never remembered to go back to it.
You could have just
I'm going to start a discussion on the Dragon's Forum after this saying, how would you reveal the true nature of an amulet of inescapable location?
Speaking of which, you can go to the dragonsfoot.org forums and leave us questions there or comments, or d20radio.com forums and sign up there and leave us comments. We have a whole section dedicated to ourselves there. So,
yeah.
Knock it out. Do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, see your name. Absolutely.
Definitely. Just like Nick, I want to see you there too.
Okay. I'm easy.
Okay, and then we'll go into another segment in just a second here. You guys have any more comments about this amulet?
The only thing I thought about it is, you know, a possibility of using it, if it is useful, I guess you can use it as something to, if I was a player, I guess if you somehow found out what this thing was, however that may be, is, you know, use it to track somebody or something. If you have
now, you're going to need to actually have, yeah, you got to have a crystal ball. Or you got to have ESP or sometimes you've got to already have some kind of magic, because all this does is double the likelihood of that magic working.
I'm wondering now that I'm thinking about it, is maybe if you have one of those items, like a crystal ball, maybe it does, when you have one of these amulets nearby, or it does clue you in on what its true nature is. Kind of get where I'm going with that?
Not really. Explain.
Well, I was thinking is, like, maybe when you have an amulet of inescapable location, when you have, maybe if you draw it close to a crystal ball or something like that, it somehow, the Dwomers are similar. So,
you know, that's
go on.
That's a good point.
So,
I like that.
So maybe that's how you're able to find out what it is. You can kind of use that as something to you know, let you know what it's all about.
I think that'd be a good way of discovering it, actually, because you would get near the crystal ball and try to – you just test it, you know, because
right.
if it really was going to shield you from crystal balls, then you would think that that would shield you from that crystal ball.
Yeah.
But, of course, it would double it up.
Yeah, or like the ESP or telepathy, you know?
All right.
Maybe that would be the same way, too.
So let us know how you use it so we can get your answers on that. And guess what, Jason?
What's
guess
that?
What I got on my doorstep again?
Oh, what? An eagle.
Well, no eagle poop, Jason. No, I actually got another scroll.
Ooh.
Oh, one of the scrolls from Thane, right?
Yep.
Oh my gosh, outstanding.
So let me just grab that scroll here and open it up so we could I hit the microphone with the scroll. Sorry about that, guys. And let me just jump right into that scroll for you guys. So without further ado, here's the new Thane segment. I mean, scroll.
I was able to sleep deeply, the first time since I set out from home many weeks ago. In the morning, Deneb and I ate as much as we could. It would be a long time before we could eat our fill again. If we survived the goblins and made the road north to my quest, we would soon be tightening our belts. Deneb had lived his whole life in this place, in misery, and now that everyone who made it bearable was dead and the end was upon him, he was impatient to be gone. It was midday, and we were near ready to depart when a hail was heard outside. Deneb turned to me with contempt in his eyes, and I knew he believed the lords of the land had come to call. If it were true, there was to be a reckoning before we left for the goblin caves. If he challenged followers of Erith Null, I would stand with him. Deneb stepped outside, but in moments had returned looking well pleased, and bid me to attend a visitor. I followed him outside and saw a woman, wiry, road-weary, but still armed with what appeared to be orc loot. She all but fell at my feet, and asked if I remembered her from the ship. She had been tracking me, and had not eaten in 4 days, and asked for food. I could see the beginnings of desperation in her plea. She was not starving, but a few more days in the wild, and she would be. Her name was Deirdre. She told me she had survived the Pommarch, and dispensed with 2 orcs that had tried to ensnare her. She found evidence of my recent passing, and had been given hope that someone else from the ship had survived, and she made haste to catch up. Between words, she ate ravenously and seemed to recover some strength from it. She must have been losing ground on me the whole way. She was smaller than me and would make poorer time. Had there been rain, she would surely have lost my trail. Deirdre was en route to Elred to serve in the court of a trading family whose younger son had pretenses to nobility. Her intended employer meant to seize an unsettled area inland from the city, clear it of threats to settlement, and claim lordship. I asked her in what capacity would she serve, and she straightened her back, cocked her head in a motion clearly rehearsed for a skeptical audience, and put her hand to the axe that hung awkwardly at her side. Woman at arms. I did not doubt it. The filthy armor she wore and the axe were of orcish manufacture. Although she was small, she had a directness about her physical presence that suggested some martial training. I could see, behind her obligation and her kindness, was a keen resourcefulness by which she survived shipwreck and dispatched with 2 orcs who meant to take her captive. I explained to her our situation, the ends at which Deneb had found himself, and the depravity of the local nobility. She had no desire to wait around for predatory goblins or an arrogant lord who would at best treat her as he had Deneb's family. Deirdre said to me, "Now that I'm with you, I feel safer than I have since I left home, and I do not wish to be parted. I will go with you against the goblins." Deneb and I were both glad. Until this moment, I doubted Deneb and I would even survive. We stayed another day in the house with Deirdre to allow her to rest. She spent some time cleaning and trimming the orc armor, and soon it looked as if it had been made for her. The next morning, we set out. Deneb led us south along the east bank of the stream. About a mile on, there was a bridge. On the western shore, the path forked, north to the manor house of the Noble of the March, and southwest to the hill country and the goblin caves. Along the road, the overgrown farms gave way to wilderness. The road faded to a footpath. Deirdre walked ahead with Deneb and asked him about his experience with drill or battle, of which he had only foggy notions that were likely to get him quickly run through. She had to stop several times to practice with Deneb, and periodically flashed a sly glance to me, amused, but also pleading. It would take some cooperation on both our part to keep this farm boy alive. Hills gradually folded up around the horizon, and we found ourselves in a rugged area after midday. Trees on either side of the path had markings meant to serve as a warning. Again, the blood symbol of Erythnol, and also other goblin signs. I quieted Deirdre and Deneb, and we began to explore the area, looking for a cave, which I soon spotted.
Wow.
Well, that's the end?
That's it?
I was just
sounds
getting
like
into
a cliffhanger.
They're at the cave, and
it's just
like the oh.
Just at the end there, it just cuts off. So I don't know what's going on.
Oh my gosh! I hope
this
you're
is
okay.
Quite a ragged little band has gotten together now with Thane.
But you know, I have hope for them. I have hope for them.
Well, we've got a cleric who's barely survived a shipwreck, a young boy who's got no training and has lost his family to the orcs and the goblins, and now this woman Deirdre, and we're not really sure who she is.
And what's her charisma?
What's more importantly, what's her comeliness?
We'll try to get character sheets on all of them.
That'd be cool. We can post it on the website. You know, Thane character.
That would be a great idea. Yeah.
I'm interested to know who this new character is now going to be. I have a bunch of other scrolls here, so maybe that's what that involves. Want me to play? Nah, I'm just kidding. I'm not playing them now.
No,
they're very fragile, and I need to open them very carefully so they do not break. So Jason needs to be here with his important equipment. So.
Yes. Well, we'll have to find out what happens next to all of them. But it's an interesting way to see how these various characters are getting together. Very different from you see a old man in a tavern and he's not looking at anything.
Yeah, that's true.
Which perhaps could lead us into one of my favorite books. Is there a segment where we could talk about books, though?
We'll head into that right now, then. Hold on.
Close your eyes and tell me what you see.
The library.
So we're in a library right now, and you wanted to talk about what this week, Jason?
So this week we've all been reading The Order of the Stick, which is a great web comic and also a printed comic that you can buy in books and used to be printed in Dragon Magazine when it was printed by Rich Berlew. What did you guys think?
Go ahead, Vince.
I thought it was awesome. I at first I was a little taken back because I didn't like the drawing of it and I was just kind of like, meh.
Yeah, so they're called the Order of the Stick, which is kind of a play on a couple of things. One is the fact that they're stick figures.
Yeah.
Right.
But in a very early episode, when they're – I don't know, actually know if this was one of the ones that ended up on the web or if you have to buy one of the prequel books for it. But they're walking along as after the adventuring party has gotten together and trying to think of a name for it. And Elan, who is their bard – is saying things like, well, there goes a cloud. Maybe we're the Brotherhood of the Cloud. And he's like, well, look, I see a puppy. Perhaps we're the Band of Puppies. And one of them says, these are ridiculous. These are stupid. You might as well look at that stick on the ground and say, ooh, now we're the Order of the Stick. And so they become the
Order
stuck.
Of the
Stick. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the bard because he's such an idiot.
Oh, Elan is the best. So let's see. We've got the characters in here. There's Roy Greenhilt, who's the human fighter that's leading the party. And
right.
One of Roy's biggest problems is being called the Big Dumb Fighter, you know, because he has an MBA, a master's.
Right, he's like the smartest dude in the group.
Yeah. And he has Elon the Bard, who, when we first met him, was being abandoned by his paladin, who he was supposed to be helping, because every time he went into battle, Elon would give away what was happening, so that he couldn't actually get anything done. Haley Starshine, who's the rogue thief for us.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, okay, I'll go through all of them really quickly. You've got Durkan, who's the dwarf who's been kicked out of his homelands. Varsuvius, the gender, ambiguously gendered elf magic user. And then my absolute favorite character, which is Belkar Bitterleaf, the slightly homicidal halfling.
Yeah. I almost forgot about him.
He's the smallest one, and he's the meanest one, and the most hilarious of the whole group.
So, after first looking at it, I was kind of taken like back. But reading a couple and getting it, you actually kind of really get into the story and really want to keep following it. So it's kind of like becomes an obsession to read the next one, the next one, the next one, and then so you can just get caught up on every little adventure they had.
Yeah, the thing is, Rich Berlow is a great storyteller.
Mm. Oh yeah, I'm at the point now where they encountered the Mind Flayer, and Mind Flayer's looking at each one. It's like from the Mind Flayer's point of view, it's like, you know, one is like he views his head as like a milkshake. Another views his head as a Diet Coke. And he looks at the magic user. He sees it as like a cheeseburger.
On
it. He goes, "Okay, now we're getting somewhere." And then he views the fighter. His head is like a big old turkey.
Yeah, I love that. Varsuvius gets all upset because the Mind Flayer is going after the fighter instead of going after the magic user.
Yes, I love that. That was just incredible. And I'm like, I can't wait to see what's next.
You haven't seen how they deal with the Mind Flayer yet?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. This isn't a spoiler. the lawyers from Wizards of the Coast show up and take it away.
Yes, that's intellectual property. You can't use that.
Oh, I love that part.
And yeah, yes, we say Mind Flayer in this podcast, so nanny nanny boo boo.
What I love about Rich Berlew is that he knows how to pace it so that, you know, you'll get your gag strips and you're just, you know, like the wizards lawyers showing up. And when the lawyers show up, they're like, "We are spooky lawyers from another place. Quit it. We don't fit in. Quit it." But then he'll go back and, you know, do these really great storylines. So there's things in there. There's a little bit of the Rachel and Ross, you know, that goes on throughout when you have Elon and Haley, you know, will they or won't they? And you've got some really great, huge story arcs. And when you get to the point of getting up to, you know, episode number 400, and you start seeing just how far ahead Rich actually planned these incredibly interweaving plot lines, you'll just be in awe.
Wow.
You know, it really shows you what a good storyteller can do. But it also, you know, if you go back to the first ones, you know, you read the first couple of dozen, and they're basically, you know, jokes that, you know, jokes about rules and, you know, kind of the usual stuff you get in a they're really funny ones, but you can see the progression over 400 strips.
So do we have a website link we could post up for people to join along in the fun if they want to?
Yeah, we'll put that on the site, but for right now, for everybody who's listening, it's Giant in the Playground Games, so it's giantitp.com, and all of the strips are up there. There's also a couple of other really good fantasy webcomics that are hosted on that site.
Yeah,
and their forums.
They're up to 700 right now, right?
It's crazy. It's crazy. Well, the Order of the Stick is up to like number 400 right now.
Okay.
So we'll have to put that into our link section as an ongoing link so people can just click on it daily to find out what's going on.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he puts up a new episode about every week or so. And the forums over at the Giant in the Playground Games, the moment he puts up a strip, you know, if you're there within, if it takes you more than an hour to get to the forums, you're going to already have 20 pages of people talking about it. So,
you know, awesome. One thing I like about it, even though it's primarily about the edition that shall not be named, there is some commonality in there. And I think you pointed that out, Jason, that there's some things that we've all encountered as gamers that we see in this strip or we've talked about. So
yeah, I don't think, you know, aside from the fact that Haley's called a rogue rather than a thief, and Varsuvius is called a wizard rather than a magic user. Other than that, I mean, the rules of the game don't really influence the comic very much. And
no,
I
don't
even notice, you know, it could really, you could think of it as a Hackmaster comic.
Yay!
but you know, like you said, there's an early strip when the characters are first getting together, and this might be in one of the books because I actually, for anybody who's interested, if you do like the comic online, there's actually 5 books. There's Dungeon Crawlin' Fools, On the Origin of PCs, No Cure for the Paladin Blues, Start of Darkness,
cool.
And the latest one, War and XPs. So
nice.
Yeah, they're good ones. But in the first, on the Origin of PCs, he has Roy is trying to get adventurers to go with him on this quest to avenge his father's blood oath, and he's going around town and he keeps going up to people. Do you want to join my group? Do you want to join my group? And none of them will. And Elan, who's been watching him, finally comes up and says, "You're doing it wrong. You know, I know all about narrative, you know, story arcs, and let me tell you what you need to do is go sit in that tavern over there." And he's like, "Oh, should I ask people?" He's like, "No, you need to sit in the tavern, put this cloak over your head, and don't look at anyone. Just look at your beer." And he's like, "Really? Is that going to work?" He's like, "Trust me, I know how these things work."
That's awesome.
It's just, yeah. Hey, there's a man with a cloak over his head sitting in the corner looking at his beer and not talking to anyone. Adventurers, see if he needs anything.
Yeah, really.
He must be important.
Yeah, and of course, you know, they've got great villains. You've got Zykon, the male, the lich sorcerer who starts out as a... Okay, so there's another thing as later as, you know, sorcerers. But anyways, he's a lich, and... he's not your typical bad guy. He's a really he's a jerk. He's not just evil. He's worse than evil. He's just kind of a jerk. And then you've got the rest of the things like the goblins, who if you get all the way through 400 episodes of this, it becomes a little bit difficult because you start understanding why the goblins are the way they are. It's amazing the way that he manages to sometimes be very one-dimensional and sometimes be so multi-dimensional that you just look at actually gaming in a slightly different light.
Huh.
So.
Awesome. So if we're going to review this out of star, now let's say swords.
Yes.
How many swords would you give this this comic strip, Jason? Out of five.
I don't know. What's, out of five?
Yeah, sorry. Out of five.
Oh, okay. Out of five. Well, five. Absolutely.
And Nick?
Oh, I would definitely give it 5 out of 5 swords.
I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 just because the story is just hilarious and it just keeps making you want to hit next.
Mm-hmm.
And that obsession just becomes more and more deeply laid.
More ways to, you know, waste our time.
Hey,
yeah, don't start reading episode number 1 at work on a, you know, on a lunch break because you're going to be fired by the end of the day.
Just one more. Yeah. Okay, cool. Tell us what you think about it. rfistaff@gmail.com.
Chock full of old school gaming goodness, like I said.
All first edition, all the way you like it, every time. Served your way.
You get center.
Yeah. Served your way right away. Oh, wait. Was I allowed to say that, Jason?
Yeah, I think so. We'll get the lawyers and ask.
Okay. So, folks, join us next week. We'll be back with another show, and we've made it into the double digits, and we're business now. We're gold.
Nice. Awesome.
Thanks to everything and everybody, what everybody does. And we'll have another Thane because we have a whole bunch of scrolls sitting here against the wall.
So. Cool. That'll be great for next time.
And hopefully we'll have some more module reviews from Blackstone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely going to look into that module you suggested earlier and Baba Yaga's hut. And just to give a little heads up on everybody on that, I will be reviewing some of the S-series of modules.
Okay.
So that'll be coming up in the future.
So we'll look forward to that. And I guess we'll get out, that'll sign us off for this week. And I'll say, keep it original, keep it old school.
Later, everybody.
Goodbye, everyone.
Good night.